Blog Talk Radio.
Coming up on The Big Show, Ken Rotkop describes the perfect pitch, Ellen Besson unleashes the magic of animation, and we review the 20 most underrated films. Next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome, everybody, to Movie Geeks United. How y'all doing tonight?
Doing great. How are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm good. I'm great. You enjoy that southern accent that I put on?
I thought that was very impressive. I don't know where that came from, but that was very cool, very innovative.
Oh, I've got a million dialects. I really do. So, how have you been, Jerry, since our Big Show Sunday?
Since our Big Show on Sunday, I've been all right. Just working, going to the gym, nothing too exciting. Nothing really to report on since the no movie. I haven't seen anything since then. So.
Last weekend on Sunday we talked about Last House on the Left with a couple of the actors from that film, and we will be seeing that this weekend. So we'll be able to offer our full review on Sunday evening, probably.
Yes, we will do that definitely.
Yeah, we're all looking forward to that. Also I'm actually looking forward to it too. Also, I wanted to let everyone know that our 70s tribute, we're paying tribute to the greatest films of the 70s. We handled McCabe and Mrs. Miller. We celebrated that film on March 1st. That was our debut episode of the series. Our next tribute show will be dedicated to none other than...
Last Tango in Paris.
Right, exactly. That will be April 1st. So if you enjoyed our tribute to McCabe and Mrs. Miller, tune into our Last Tango in Paris show. We're still firming up the guests for that evening's broadcast. But it's a fascinating movie, and it's a fascinating story.
Yeah, I'm going to watch it. I haven't seen that in years, so I can't wait to watch that again. So that should be. I'm really looking forward to talking about that.
It's always been one of my favorite movies, to which everyone... in my family, looks at me very, very
odd. Why? That's like one of the classic movies of the 70s. Why would people look at you like... I mean, I mean that very seriously. Why would people...
My family, they're not necessarily film purists like I am. So
right. Right, no, I understand. I mean, maybe people who, like, make butter or something might look at you funny, but otherwise than that, I really can't think of it, you know?
Actually, you know, when I was 12, I first saw it when I was 12, that probably explains a lot about why I am the way I am now. But I got so excited by it, intellectually stimulated by it, that I played Marlon Brando's scene for my parents. I said, you guys got to see this. It's the most amazing piece of acting I've ever seen, where he's at his dead wife's bedside, and he's cursing her, and it evolves into kind of a declaration of intense love and despair that she's gone and he doesn't understand why. I thought it was the most incredible performance piece I'd ever seen. But it has horrifying language in that scene, so my parents were horrified.
Your parents were probably like, oh my God.
My 12-year-old son, what is he into? But we're into Last Tango in Paris. On April 1st, we'll be paying tribute to that film. And upcoming shows, we'll be speaking about the annual Sarasota Film Festival. We'll be speaking about the annual South by Southwest Filmmaker and conversing with filmmakers from both of those. And we also have... the director of Lime Life, which is a new film starring Alec Baldwin, and we could have Alec Baldwin as well for that show. And the great Buck Howard. Well, we will be speaking to the person the film is based on, and that would be the amazing Kreskin. Who knew?
That would be pretty cool. You know?
So I'm just going to have him predict all the questions.
Yeah.
It'll be an easy interview for me. Our first interview tonight, we're really excited about this show. We're going to learn some stuff tonight.
We are.
We're always excited about that. Ken Rotkop is an award-winning screenwriter and one of our most sought-after screenwriting instructors. He's worked to bridge the gap between aspiring screenwriters and Hollywood with his revolutionary forum known as PitchMart. You can read all about it at www.pitchmart.com. He wrote and produced for us The Living, the story of Medgar Evers, a project that won him the Writers Guild Award, the Neil Simon Award, and the NAACP Image Award. He's been the creative head of four studios, and he and his workshops are the subject of a feature-length documentary titled Talk Fast, which has won great acclaim at film festivals throughout the country. The second edition of his best-selling book, The Perfect Pitch, How to Sell Yourself and Your Movie Idea to Hollywood, is now available for purchase. Actually, you can click on the book's front cover icon that you find there on our homepage and purchase it for yourself as you listen to this interview. And this man knows the art of successful pitching better than anyone else in the business. None other than Oprah Winfrey raves, Ken Rotkop is the master at teaching writers how to pitch. It is a great pleasure to welcome to Movie Geeks United, Mr. Ken Rotkop. Ken, are you with us?
I am, Jamie.
How are you, sir? Thanks so much.
I'm fine. Thank you for that nice introduction.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed your book a lot, and I learned so much from reading it. Tell me how you got involved in the business before we get into your book.
Oh, boy. That may take 3 hours for openers. How did I get started in the business? I had met this very attractive lady in New York, and she was modeling, and we fell in love and decided to come to Los Angeles to get married.
Mm-hmm.
I was in advertising in New York at the time. I was a copywriter for an ad agency.
Mm-hmm.
And I only knew one person out here, a fellow named Wes Kenny, who was directing a game show.
Right.
And I asked Wes if he would be the best man at my wedding. He said he would. And so came out, got married, and went off to Acapulco on our honeymoon. Got a phone call from Wes Kenny in Acapulco saying, how would you like to come back and write this game show for 1 month because the writer on the show is taking a sabbatical?
Mm.
I said, they have writers on game shows? What is it?
Yeah, I was always shocked by that myself.
Well, he says, this is a show that has celebrities, and they have to... the name of the show is Your First Impression, and you ask them the beginning of questions, or you make a beginning of a statement, and they have to finish it with the first thing that comes to mind. And and you have a panel that's trying to guess who the celebrity is because he's hidden from the panel, he or she's hidden from the panel. And you'll have to go every day to a different celebrity's home and play the game with them so that they know exactly what to do. And then kind of hold their hand on the show until they come out on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I said, God, that sounds fabulous. So
yeah.
I called the ad agency in New York, and I said, gee, I got a chance to work on a show for a month. They said, fine. They said, the guy that we got to replace you for the time that you went on your honeymoon is much better than you, so good, you know, take as much time as you want.
Huh.
So off to Hollywood I went with my new wife who was from Beverly Hills, and she was very unhappy. She wanted to be back in New York, but I said, it's only for a month. Well, 40 years later, I'm still here. What happened after that first month, the producer fired the writer who had taken the sabbatical and kept me on. Not that I was any better than he was. I probably worked cheaper. The producer was a man named Monty Hall. Monty and,
wow.
and I have become
oh, wow, okay.
through the years, and I stayed on for the length of the show, which ran about 2 years. And from there, one thing led to another, and before I knew it, I was in the business with both feet, and gave up my job at the ad agency in New York, obviously, and was now living in Los Angeles, and I've been very, very fortunate. In the 40 years that I have been out here, I have worked almost constantly, which I know a lot of writers can't make that time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's true. Right. Now, when you were a copywriter for the ad agency, did you have dreams of a career in filmmaking?
I don't think so. I don't think that I thought that was beyond anything that I could possibly conceive of myself doing. That was for the grown-ups, you know.
Right.
I don't think I thought about it at all. I must say, in light of that, when the first award that I won for my writing was the Writers Guild Award, and it was a black tie affair at the Wilshire Hotel here in Los Angeles, and I believe it was Dick Gregory who opened the envelope and named off the five nominations. And when he said, and the best screenplay for a television movie for the year goes to Ken Rodkop for Us for Living, I ran from my seat, from our table, which was way in the back of the room. I raced up to the stage saying to myself, I know he's made a mistake, and any moment now he's going to change it, and I got to get up there before he makes the change. That's how little faith I had in myself. Suddenly, there I was standing on that stage and being given the award and told I had just written the best television movie of the year.
Wow. Yeah. I want to talk to you about that project. But obviously, to get to that point, you went through a lot of, when you had finished work that you were ready to go with, you had a lot of experiences with pitching, obviously. This is your particular expertise that you've written your books on. I'm wondering about the learning curve that you went through, starting with those earlier experiences. Was it a very embarrassing, kind of humiliating process, or were you confident right from the get-go?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Oh, my God, nervousness, walking into meetings, perspiration. I was afraid to shake hands with the executive I was meeting with because I knew my hand was wringing wet, and I didn't want to screw up. That was all I could think about.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you, a couple of years after that, and I had certain success, and then Joseph E. Levine invited me to be a creative head of Embassy Pictures out on the West Coast. And here I am now sitting at this big desk in this huge office, and all these people are coming in and pitching to me. And more than once, maybe a half dozen times, after I would meet with some young writer, he would call me on the phone the next day and say, "Oh, Mr. Rodkop, I said such a stupid thing at the meeting yesterday. You must think I'm a real jerk." And I would say to myself, that's what I used to think. God, I remember walking out of one meeting and banging my head on the wall in the hallway for saying something that I, as the words were coming out of my mouth, I said, this is so stupid. What am I saying this for? But I couldn't stop myself. And now suddenly here I am.
And you talk about that in your book.
Suddenly here I am, an executive. And somebody is saying this to me, and I don't know what the hell he's talking about. I've had 15 meetings the day before. He was just one of the meetings.
Right.
You don't hang on every word. You know, you get kind of a gestalt feeling for people. And, I would tell him, forget it. I don't even know what the hell you're talking about. I wish I had known that when I started out, when I was saying these stupid things. But anyway, you're right. I was able to write about it in my book, and hopefully it'll be helpful to other young writers, aspiring writers, when they go out for some of their first pitch meetings.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the whole book is filled with great lessons that will inspire young writers. Let me ask you about who you're pitching to, because I think it's important to understand the mentality of the person you're pitching to, the executive or the person from the studio, whoever it might be. Who are they generally, and what are they looking for?
That's a great question. I try to do as much research on the person that I'm going to be meeting with if I have not met them before. I try to find out literally as much as I can about him. I'll even talk to other writers. Hey, did you ever pitch to so on and so forth? What kind of guy is he? What does he talk about? What is he like? And if I can find out, because I'm a sports fanatic, if I can find out some guy is a Dodger fan or loves pro football or whatever, I feel it gives me a little edge because we have something we can bond on before we start talking about the story I'm about to pitch.
Yeah.
I try to find out what movies they've made so I can talk to them about some of their films. Anything that I can to ingratiate myself to them before I get into the pitch. Because when you have a pitch meeting, you're being judged on two levels. You're not only being judged on your story, you're being judged on what kind of a person they think you are.
Mm-hmm.
Are you somebody they want to work with?
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a terrific story, but if they think you're a major jerk, if they think you're going to be a troublemaker,
mm-hmm.
if they think you're going to be a whiner, if they think you're going to be somebody who's paranoid about everything, they just don't want to get involved. There's too much material out there. They don't have to get involved with this
world.
Yeah. Now, this poses a dilemma, and I know that you cover it in your book, in that a lot of writers are kind of isolated observers. They full title of this book is How to Sell Yourself and Your Movie Idea to Hollywood. And I think that's a really difficult component of this for a lot of writers, how to sell yourself, because just by their very nature, they tend to be kind of more insulated and isolated.
True.
It's a bitch for a lot of writers. You're absolutely right. I have been hired by writers and or their agents to go in and pitch for them because they just can't get the words out. And I won't tell you the names because they are some of the biggest writers in Hollywood. Credits as long as my arm. Credits I wish I had.
Right.
And I'm hired to go and pitch their story for them because they absolutely cannot communicate verbally.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because they want it so badly. As we all do when we walk into a meeting.
Excuse me, Ken, does that, when you do that for like a certain writer or something, when you go to the people that you're pitching to, do they know that? Do they mind? Do they hold that against the writer, or they, because it's you doing it, they don't mind that?
Not at all. No.
Okay.
They don't. They know that some writers get tongue-tied.
That's an incredible service. I have not heard of that. That's incredible.
Yeah.
We do that for writers. I have something that we call pitch marts. I have workshops, and I have correspondent writers literally all over the country, all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And our pitch marts are twice a year, and it's a chance for the writers who are in my workshop or my correspondent people to come in. We take over a restaurant for a day. And it's an opportunity for them to meet about 25 top executives and pitch their stories to them. Well, a lot of writers can't afford to fly across the country or come in from Australia or Germany or Romania, Ireland, where I have writers from. And we hire actors to pitch their stories for them. It's a service that we provide.
That's a great service. I've never heard of that. That's incredible.
We're the only ones that do it.
That is amazing. That makes perfect sense. Now, would you recommend rehearsing your pitch? But the thing about that is you don't want it to feel too mannered or studied. You want to be a personable presence.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, I don't. Gosh, if you don't know your story, who does know it? You know.
Yeah.
That's true.
No, I'd rather not. I'd rather you be much more conversational. And as I say in the book, there must be a half a dozen books out on pitching. Some say I can teach you to pitch in 30 seconds, and some say I can teach you to pitch in 5 minutes, and I can teach. I have found after 2 minutes, most executives' eyes glaze over.
Yeah.
I figure you got 2 minutes to
mm-hmm.
sell them. In fact, in truth, you have 30 seconds, because after the first 30 seconds of your pitch, they've made up their mind whether they want your story or not. And they're really, after that, all you can do after that is screw it up.
Yeah.
So I say keep the pitch short. Let them ask you questions. You know, if they're enticed by the pitch, they'll then ask you questions about your script, and it's much easier to answer questions than it is to actually pitch.
Yeah. But the most important element that you have to have, and this takes care of a lot when you go in there, you have to have a finished screenplay, obviously, that you are passionate about.
Well, if you weren't passionate, you shouldn't write it in the first place.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing once you start to make a career of it, and I got to be honest, I'm hired to write some stuff that, you know, it's crap, but I do the best I can.
Right.
In fact, I probably work harder on those stories that I'm hired to write that I don't believe in than the ones I do believe in, because those fly off my computer. But the others, I try to do the best I can.
Mm-hmm.
But that's once you've made kind of a name for yourself and people come to you with assignments. But if you're writing on speculation, my God, if you're not passionate about your project, then don't get into the business.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Now, there's some people, some purists, some naysayers, let me just bring this out and get your opinion on it, that say if you've written something and you're very passionate about it and you can convey what the script is and its potential in 2 minutes, in between 30 seconds and 2 minutes, is that still a project? Is it even worth doing if it can be simplified that much?
No, because you're pitching to people who have been in the business for such a long period of time, most of them anyway, that within 30 seconds they get it.
Yeah.
They get it. They know about and they'll ask you questions. So yes, I always, as I probably said in the book and talk about when I lecture, there's only two things in this whole world that I've taught my two daughters when they were growing up. One was to do everything enthusiastically, and the other was to do it with passion.
Yeah.
If you have enthusiasm and passion, then everything else is easy.
Right.
And that's what I tell the writers when they pitch. My God, be enthused about it. This is your baby, and if you can't talk about it passionately, then it's not worth talking about.
I have a question just about pitching. Do you recommend or do you see it a lot still where is it best to use, like, the high-concept method to sell the movie? It's like using, like, an older movie, like it's like Die Hard, and like Speed, Die Hard on a bus or something. Do you find that still works?
I'd rather not do it or recommend it for new writers.
Okay.
It becomes a crutch.
Oh, I understand.
You know, once you're in the business for a long time, then that's almost like the shorthand of the business.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually heard writers say, you take the opening from Casablanca, remember Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, then you do the second scene from Whatever Happened to Baby, and before you know it, he's mentioned 15 different movies, and the executive says, God, that sounds great. And I'm sitting there saying, what the hell is he talking about?
Right, right.
I don't recommend that for first-time writers.
It's Annie Hall meets The Magnificent Seven.
That's quite a film. Let's take it.
I love it. I'll buy it.
yeah, exactly. Now, tell me about the marketplace out there. Now, obviously, we're through a recession, and I think that'll translate into Hollywood as time goes on. But with the advent of home entertainment and more kind of direct-to-DVD and on-demand and all these different opportunities, does that translate to more opportunities for writers?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It truly is the golden age for writers. And as far as the recession is concerned, while the whole nation is struggling, the one industry that has done better this year than they did last year, better last year than they did the year before, is the motion picture industry.
Mm-hmm. It's reassuring.
People have less bucks to spend on entertainment, and they'd rather spend it on a movie than to take a long trip that they can't afford.
Yeah, I agree.
If you're a new writer, everybody's looking for material right now. Everybody.
We talked a little bit about the confidence it takes to get in there and pitch your project, and that grows over time, I'm sure. But writers and all creative people tend to have a lot of pride as well, whether it's false pride or not. But when the person you're pitching to offers suggestions that might run counter to your beliefs about your screenplay, how do you handle that?
Yeah, first of all, you have to understand, as Gore Vidal says, when you complete a script, you have taken a pregnancy, gone through the 9 months or however long it took you, and you've now given birth to this baby that you call a screenplay, or a play, as he would call it.
Mm-hmm.
You've given birth, and now you're taking that baby and showing it to other people, and God knows the last thing you want to hear is, God, is that an ugly baby?
Yeah.
And what was your question again?
do you have to remain open to those suggestions, correct?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. People, right. There are lots of executives that will that like to think they're creative. Some are. I would say maybe of all the executives that I've ever pitched to, I would say maybe one out of every seven is creative.
Mm-hmm.
The other six think they are, and they're not at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think of Blake Edwards when his agent said to him, why don't you come up with a TV idea? We can go into ABC and sell it. They want to do business with you. And he said, I don't do television. I only do feature films. Come on, Blake, come up with something. So he came up with a concept, and they set up a meeting at ABC, and there were five or six people in the office sitting around waiting anxiously for him to come in. And he comes in, he sits down with his agent, and he pitches a story about an old Gothic home in San Diego that just goes on the market, and two women show up at the same time to meet with the owner of the building. They want to rent the house.
Mm.
One has three kids, the other one has two kids. They're both recently divorced, and the house would be ideal. The owner of the house doesn't know which one to give it to and makes a decision. Can you people possibly live together? Because the house is so huge that you can both move in with your kids. And the two women think it's a great idea, and they do so. The only problem is that immediately through the neighborhood, everybody talks about these two dykes, these two lesbians who have taken over a house. And no matter what these girls do, if they look at each other, they're looking at each other. If they touch each other, see what they're doing? They're touching each other. If they don't touch each other, look, they're trying to. Well, anyway, that was Blake Edwards' pitch, and he says it's a lot of humor in homosexuality, and it's never been done before, and I'd like to be the first one to do it. And these executives conferred for a second, and one of them turned to Blake and said, it's a very good idea, but instead of lesbians, could you make them witches instead? Now, you or I might say, witches, Jesus, what a great idea. I never thought of that. Witches, of course, you know, because you want the deal.
Yeah.
Blake Edwards was furious. Says, I didn't come in here to tell you a story about witches. Packed up and walked out and never went back to the networks.
Yeah. I read that story in your book, and they're crazy. I would have bought a story about lesbians in a minute. So tell me about the film that you did. You wrote and produced For Us, The Living, the story of Medgar Evers. Lawrence Fishburne was in the film.
Howard Rollins, Irene Cara, Paul Winfield, Roscoe Lee Brown. It was a wonderful experience. Merle Evers, which was Medgar Evers' widow, was by my side throughout the shooting and was there to work with me on the script as well as her children. I wrote the script with Ossie Davis.
Mm.
At least we started to write together, and after the first week together, Ossie said to me, Ken, I can't write this script because I knew Medgar. I marched with him. I was there when his house was bombed. He said, I just feel like I'm making money off of Medgar's death, and I just can't do it. And I went to Chuck Freeze, who was my executive producer, and I said, Chuck, what are we going to do? Ozzy's walking off. He says, well, let's not tell anybody, and you go off and write it yourself.
Yeah.
And I did, and I made sure that Ozzy got equal credit with me, and so we shared all the awards that we won.
Now, it's an amazing story, and it demands to be told, and I'm so happy that you did. But here's what I'm getting at. Did you have to pitch the project?
I sure did. And at that time, I had no credits as my credits were in game shows they didn't want to. They said, this is too important a project. Let's bring in a top writer. Mm. And Chuck Freeze, bless his heart, stood up for me as the executive producer, and he said, look, we will back Ken. We will guarantee that he will deliver. And the network said, I'll tell you what, will Ken write it with a top black writer? And I was just thrilled enough to be involved. And
yeah.
And that's how Ossie Davis came on board for all of 1 week. yes, I did pitch it. It was a very unusual situation because just before that, I was hired to be the only white on an all-black cast and crew on a TV series called Images of America, which was on CBS,
mm-hmm.
and it and each week it told a different part of the history of the Black American experience. They had hired a black writer. He wasn't doing the job. They had fired him, and so CBS owed me one at that time. I can tell you that story later, but they brought me in, and none of these guys really wanted me. And they started asking me questions. Do you know about Harlem? And I did, having lived in New York. I was able to tell them a lot about the history of Harlem. They said, okay. And do you know about Martin Luther King? Well, I did, of course. So told them a little about that. And then they said, how about Medgar Evers? And I said, wasn't he the second baseman for the Chicago Cubs? Wasn't it Evers to Chance? And they said, boy, if you want to work on this show, you come back tomorrow and tell us who Medgar Evers was.
Wow.
And so I went to the library, and there was one book written by his wife, Merle Evers. I went home that night, I read that book, and I remember crying, sitting up in bed and crying. It was such a touching story. I said, my God, this is a movie. Went back the next day, told them about Medgar Evers. They hired me. I ended up writing the series. We won the Unity Award for it, and everybody was pleased. And when the show ended, when the series ended, I took that script, that Medgar Evers script, which was only a half-hour show, and that's the script that I brought around to the networks, and they bought it and made the deal.
Wow, wow. The book is called The Perfect Pitch: How to Sell Yourself and Your Movie Idea to Hollywood. If you'd like more information on the book, on Ken, or his workshops, visit www.pitchmart.com. Ken, I love the book. I love having you on. Come back anytime in the future.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it, and I wish both of you lots and lots of luck.
Thank you very much, sir.
Take care now.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That is Ken Rodkop. The book, The Perfect Pitch, is available for purchase right there on our homepage. Pick it up, read it. It's a lot of fun, and it's
it's so, what he was saying, so important. I mean, I just thought that was incredible that he actually would go in and pitch for you. That's incredible. I've never heard that.
That is good. I wonder if he'll go into a baseball game and pitch for you too.
I don't know. I was waiting for that to come up,
that's an easy joke.
Yes.
Jason
O'Brien will help you too.
Yeah. In just a little bit, the top of the hour, we'll be speaking to another author and instructor who has a terrific new book on animation. It's called Animation Unleashed. Ellen Besson will be with us. It's a great book, very attractive book, too. So we're excited about that. But first, I found an interesting list, Jerry.
Okay. Let's do it, because we made sure I wasn't going to find out what it was. We agreed that it would be a surprise.
It's a list compiled by Total Film users, readers. I don't know if these things have readers anymore, if they're released in magazine form anymore or not.
What's the magazine this was in? No, what?
Total Film.
Oh, yeah, Total. I think I used to get this a long time ago, this magazine.
I'm not going to post a link because I don't want people jumping ahead and, you know.
This is our show. Only we can talk about it.
That's right. No one else has seen this list. It's been online
for several weeks.
Only me. The most underrated movies, the 20 most underrated movies. Some of these are just absolutely dead on. And some of these are real head scratchers. Really?
Okay.
Yeah, really? So I wanted to get your take on it and our listeners' takes on it, whether you're calling in and and you're listening in on the chat room. You can submit some ideas in the chat room or call in, whatever you want.
Okay, so these are what they think are the underrated movies.
That's exactly it.
Did you see what Jason O'Brien just wrote?
Does everyone understand the concept?
I think Jason does.
21, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That did not make the list, but yeah.
That's
number 20.
21 reference tonight.
Number 20, the top 20, not the top 21, Jason. 21 would be 21. Number 20 is Castaway.
That's underrated?
So they say. They offer a quote from the critic of The Guardian that says, "A 2-hour, 20-minute advertisement for FedEx. Deeply silly."
Okay.
Do you find that that's a generally underrated film?
No, it got very good reviews when it came out. It did very well. I liked it. It's actually, yeah, it's a really good performance by Tom Hanks, but I don't think it's underrated. That's an odd choice, I think, because it's something that did very well, critically and commercially when
it
came
certainly
out.
Commercially, yeah.
Yeah.
So as we're going along, go ahead and give your opinion in the chat room. Castaway, the number 20 underrated film, whether or not you believe that deserves to be designated as an underrated film.
Okay, I see why, because they probably thought Wilson probably never got a better choice of roles after that. Like, he never got, like, offered the lead in Dodgeball or anything like that. So I guess that would be something.
That would have been the perfect vehicle for Wilson.
It would have been. It would, really.
Here's a head-scratcher. Our first head-scratcher. Number 19, Blades of Glory.
underrated. The best part about that movie is Amy Poehler. I think that's the first movie where she comes into her own, steals it from everyone else. But I don't really have a feeling. It's not like something they go, oh God, I really wish Blades of Glory had like really taken every award that year. It's a fun movie, but it's not something. You know, it's like as far as Will Ferrell and what's the guy named Napoleon Dynamite?
Header,
they're like sort of wearing out their welcome with those kind of movies.
Yeah,
wouldn't you say that's when that starts, or maybe?
Well, I would agree with what this critic from the Chicago Sun-Times said about it. It's a fine 10-minute Saturday Night Live sketch that's padded with another 80 minutes of filler.
I mean that's really what it is. But like I said, to me, Amy Poehler was the like life of that movie. So I don't underrate it. Oh God, I can see this is where we got Castaway and Blades of Glory. Oh my God, what's coming next?
Number 18, Reign of Fire.
How do I say this? It's a good movie. It's a fun movie. Mm-hmm. Christian Bale's very good in it. Matthew McConaughey, who is good in his one of his few roles where he's not with Kate Hudson. So it's a fun movie, a very B movie. But
does he take his shirt off in it? That's what I'm wondering.
He takes a lot off in it, I think, but but it's a fun movie. But these are not. This is not what I was thinking when you came up with this. When you told me about this,
By the way, let me just clear something up. I'm not wondering if Matthew McConaughey takes his shirt off because it's something I'd like to see. It's because he has a habit of taking his shirt off in every movie he does.
See,
it's like Ben. It's like Ben Affleck crying. It's something that they do every movie. I would probably go with this. I don't know, top 20. This is a pretty limited list. It's not like an all-time list. But because very few people saw it, at least in its theatrical run, it wasn't even a modest success, I don't think, in theatrical. So, and I heard that it was a lot of fun, and not what Joe Queenan calls Water World with reptiles.
Well, I mean, it's a fun movie. I mean, it had some, like, really cool, like, pop culture references in it.
Mm-hmm.
From what I remember, that was, like, this is 7 years ago, but... Okay, it's just not what I was thinking. Okay, let's move along.
Number 17, Velvet Goldmine.
Yes.
Yeah.
That I definitely is very underrated. For the Christian Bale performance, Todd Haynes' direction, because I think that when you watch I'm Not There years later, you see the seeds of that, the seeds of genius in I'm Not There. Are in Velvet Goldmine, and it's just, I liked Velvet Goldmine. I know a lot of people didn't, but I thought the performances were excellent.
It's also a film that lends itself to kind of underground status, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of that movie. It's designed that way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, next on the list, as most Todd Haynes films are.
Yeah.
Now, this is the oddball of the whole list. You ready?
Yeah.
Number 16. Jingle All the Way.
Huh?
this is a fascinating list. I'm curious.
Why is Jingle All the Way in it? If anything, that movie should have been like Little Jake Lloyd is in that, the future Anakin Skywalker. And if we would have only known then, no, don't put it in the movie.
Yeah. Here's what they say about it. Uptight audiences looking for one last action hero outing from Arnie failed to see that this Christmas pileup was his best comedy work by miles. As Arnie's neighbor, Phil Hartman brings some of the Simpson smug suburban class to the film.
Oh, God,
while
he
the
was
big,
in that.
Yeah. Oh, while the big man's running battle with fellow dad on a mission, Sinbad, which right there, Sinbad, it's going to be...
Yeah, it made First Kid look like Citizen Kane.
It's going to be sinfully bad. Parodies his own action career, and the big fight set piece featuring a knockoff factory full of counterfeiting Santas is amazing.
I mean, this is even worse. Were they paid to write that? The same people paid Aaron to talk about Twilight on Sunday? Were they paid to write that?
I thought that would come up.
Yeah, you knew it.
Twilight is not on this list. But number 15, I think this will be the one that you agree with the most on this list, Jerry.
Okay.
By the way, if anyone can hear the static on my phone is staticking bad on my end. I apologize for it. But let me know if you can hear it, so I know if it's just my end or yours too. Number 15, Southland Tales.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, without a doubt. I'm glad. All right, this list is already going up in my book.
Mm-hmm.
No, but it really does, and that's because we're talking about, like, in relation to Watchmen, and I just think Southland Tales, from years from now, I think people look back on it and say, I can see what he was trying to do. And it's actually kind of what we were talking about with Ken earlier about, you mentioned all the guy was mentioning, like, the 15 different films that are in the pitch, it's like this. That's what Southland Tales is, essentially,
mm-hmm.
20 different films in a 2-hour and 40-minute film. But, yeah, that's the first film on here I can definitely see that belongs to be on this list.
Okay, we have two more minutes to get to number 10, so let's race through these.
Oh, shit.
Number 14, Silent Hill.
That has a cult following, that film.
It does. I didn't get it. I didn't flow with this one. This is one I didn't enjoy.
It's okay, but I mean, I can sort of see that, though, because that does have a big cult following on the web, I've noticed.
Yeah, yeah. They say give it another go, and this time ignore all story points, barring the loss of the child. Suddenly it becomes a surprisingly effective horror of guilt, loss, and big monsters with giant cones on their heads. You know, that's... How can something be underrated when it's recommended to you that you ignore... all story points,
yeah.
Except for one.
What's up with that? Who wrote the copy on this?
If you ignore 90% of the movie, it's quite underrated. Number 13, One Night at McCool's.
Really?
Yeah.
I could take or leave it.
A poor man's To Die For, isn't it?
I don't know. That's a bold statement on your part. But
I just made it up.
That's
I made
good.
Up. I'm right.
That was brilliant. But I honestly don't have an opinion one way or the other.
They say it's the sexy Rashomon for the 90s.
Who is writing this copy.
That's actually pretty good.
It is, but I mean,
yeah.
Well, we got one on here I really think is worthwhile.
While Elvis Mitchell, his criticism of it that they sample here says, it's grabbing you by the lapels and screaming, laugh. The movie is so heavily italicized that it's not very funny. Mm. It's kind of like Last House on the Left, what we talked about Sunday. number 12. You might agree with this, and so might I, because this is a director we both admire. We need to do a tribute show to this director, because he's done a couple of what I think are some of the most amazing films. And that's Peter Weir. And number 12 is Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World.
Oh, I agree with this completely. Now, this one I really do. I think it's one of Russell Crowe's best performances. I was actually hoping they might be making another one, because there are a lot of books in the series, but I agree with this 100%.
Yeah. Okay, whereas with Silent Hill, you know, I didn't like the silence, and I didn't much care for the hill. But Master and Commander, I liked both the Master and the Commander.
Yes. No, that was an excellent movie. Superb.
Yeah, it really is, and it didn't that was certainly one that didn't get attention that it deserved.
Right. With the Oscar nominations it got, that didn't help.
Yeah, you know, another one I put on here that they did not, with multiple Oscar nominations that didn't get the acclaim it deserved, was The Insider.
Oh, yeah, that definitely deserves to be on there.
Absolutely. One that doesn't, though, is our number 11. It's not ours. It's Total Films. Van Helsing.
Okay. You know, they pick a good one like Master and Commander, and then they really just botch it. Van Helsing. Oh, my God.
Okay. You hate us, you hate us, you like us. You like us a lot, you hate us again. Yeah. That's what this list is.
Yeah.
Van Helsing.
That's a conversation killer.
Van Helsing has wit, pace, expensive action scenes, and Hugh Jackman's excellent hat.
Whatever. Thank but God he hosted the Oscars.
If you only ignore 90% of the story points. number 10 might be agreeable here. Number 10 is Frank Darabont's The Mist.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. Okay, we have three so far that I think are definitely underrated.
Yeah, I was surprised that The Mist didn't do better than it did.
I'm not, given, you know, the more I think about it, it's a great film. And actually,
it's a perfect holiday film.
What is it with the wine scenes and releasing these? They release Grindhouse on Easter weekend, and then they do this for Thanksgiving. I mean, what is it with them?
This was Thanksgiving, and you really gave thanks that your life was nothing like this.
Exactly.
Yeah, I like the ending.
The ending is superb.
Was that the original ending that they showed in the theater? It was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, and they had an alternate happy ending that he was brave enough not to go with, if I remember.
Thank God, yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember if I liked it or not. I like that he was brave enough to go that far.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a problem with it. I don't remember what it is right now. Sorry, that's anticlimactic. I hate to do that to my listeners. Number 9, 1941. And by the way, they misspell Steven Spielberg's name.
So these guys are not there. Who's writing the copy? What's it now? You know, I've seen it many times. It is, you know, a good friend of mine, I remember I watched like an unrated edition on VHS back in the late 90s. And why would you watch it again? I like the parts with Belushi, I think, are kind of funny.
Right.
But it's not, it is like Steven Spielberg's first really bad film. Because, I mean, I think there's some really funny scenes. But then there's some other parts. It's just too long. It's too much almost.
Yeah, yeah. That's just it. That's the mantra that the movie lives by. Too much.
Yeah.
It's overly ambitious. It's throwing everything into the pot, and the movie suffers for that. I think Spielberg, as he was doing it, realized, you know, I'm going too far. I'm going too crazy with this.
No, let me. Eric G in the chat room said it's hilarious. It is a funny movie, but it doesn't. It just doesn't work as well as I'm sure it looked great on paper. I mean, there's some great scenes, though, very funny scenes in it. But as a whole, there's always something missing.
Yeah, yeah. Possibly. I would be interested in looking back at it today, with kind of an innocence. Maybe that would help. But I think it's more so where Spielberg was and that this wasn't a confident work like a Jaws or a Close Encounters.
Right.
Something to that effect. I'm just ad-libbing here. Our number 8 is – you'll agree with this. Number 8 is Catherine Bigelow's Strange Days.
Yes, I would agree with that. That's another great actor. I think it's one of her, I mean, I like her a lot, but I thought that was one of her best roles, and definitely one of Angela Bassett's just incredible, towering performances. Ralph Fiennes is good. Tom Sizemore. And that movie was released the week of the O.J. verdict.
Yeah.
And that was, it came out, and it was everything that verdict and the aftermath of that verdict was about.
Mm.
And it just got lost in the shuffle.
The trial went on for 2 years, so they had plenty of time to make the film.
Yeah, but I mean, the subtext of the film and everything.
Yeah.
And it was amazing, but that film just got lost in the shuffle. But I remember we went to go see that after work when it came out, and we were just all, like, really impressed with it. I really was. I still think it's a great film.
Yeah, it's a great film. And I remember, too, you mentioned O.J. I remember the day that O.J. fled in the Ford Explorer. It was on a Friday, the day
I remember that, yeah.
The Wolf came out, yeah.
Yeah.
And people look at that. I mean, Hollywood people look at that and say, nobody's going to go to the movies tonight. They're all going to be buried in their TV.
Yeah.
It was really worrisome for the
people. Yeah, it was,
All right, number 7, 10 Things I Hate About You.
I don't think that's underrated. I think that movie's got, I mean, it's a great comedy. It has Heath Ledger and Julia Stiles are wonderful. But that movie is always talked about in very high regard for that genre because, it's a very smart hit film and still holds up well. I don't really think of that as underappreciated.
I agree with you. By the way, it was a white Bronco. Thank you, Eric G. in the chat room for correcting me. I'm sure he'll be here all night to correct me. Our number 6 movie...
The pre-lap.
I don't know what I think about this. Number 6, Superman 3.
It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
It was just a disappointment.
BBC, Jamie Woolley from the BBC said it was slow and uninspiring. It's clear the filmmakers were scrabbling around for new ideas to keep audiences entertained. While the editorial here says, if blockbusters are measured by their set pieces, then Superman 3 is a success. It contains at least 3 classics, Superman freezing a lake to put out a disastrous chemical plant fire, Superman using a small glass of acid to destroy a supercomputer, which has made its own cyborg lady, and evil Superman fighting Clark Kent in a scrapyard, which is confusing if you're 5, but also amazing. And they say the humor's good, great action, and Clark's mom from Smallville when she was still hot.
God.
By the way, speaking of Annette O'Toole, which is the actress that they're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
She was in, you're going to hear groaning in the chat room, if that's possible. She was in Barry Manilow's TV movie Copacabana. That's a piece of trivia for you. And... we just got offered a talent. He produced that movie. He's not doing the show because he produced that movie. That movie was 23 years ago, but he's on for another project.
Oh,
and
cool.
You know, if I had him on, I'd spend 20 minutes talking about Barry Manilow.
I know.
The other 10 minutes talking about his project.
Yeah.
All right, Superman 3, I don't think it belongs there, even though the concept was a little cool, but the execution was not, with the evil Superman, the good Superman, you know, the id and the whatever. This one I think belongs here. Number 5, Cameron Crowe's Vanilla Sky.
Yeah, it's an interesting film. If you've never seen Open Your Eyes, the movie it's based on, it's definitely, I could see, I had just seen a couple of years ago Open Your Eyes, so, to me, Vanilla Sky was like really just a direct, kind of almost scene by scene, but because it is Cameron Crowe, there's a lot of neat tricks in it, a lot of neat scenes, and I think some of the performances are very good.
Yeah, when I first saw Vanilla Sky, I didn't like it, and I had seen Open Your Eyes, and it's pretty darn faithful.
Very faithful.
But the second time I watched it, something happened. It grows on me the more I watch it, which I love movies like that. And the sound design... that kind of bleeds in all the pop culture references that we've been experiencing for these 2 hours when he starts to go absolutely mad at the end.
Yeah.
Incredible experience the movie is. I think I don't think it's been appreciated as much as it should.
No. I like Cameron Crowe. I'm always willing to. I like his use of music in movies. Like, I think I like the soundtrack to Elizabethtown better than the actual movie. But I know people who tell me I should give Elizabethtown another chance because they say it's really worth it. So he's an interesting director, and he doesn't make enough movies lately. But
yeah,
I like him.
Yeah. Number four. I want you to reiterate. I want you to repeat. Like, when I say number four, I want you to say number four. Like
number four.
Thank you. Don't forget to do that. We have three more after this.
Okay.
I fully agree with this one. Twin Peaks: Fire Walk With Me.
Definitely. Yeah. This always gets the short shift when we're talking about David Lynch. No one ever mentions this film.
Yes. Time Out initially reviewed it by saying the whole thing looks like offcuts from the series that were eliminated because they're either too nasty or too inept. Self-parody would seem too generous an assessment of Lynch's aims and achievement. This is another film that grows on me. It overwhelmed me when I first watched it, and I don't go into a Lynch movie expecting to understand it. So it overwhelmed me. And talk about sound. Lynch is one of our finest directors in terms of the visuals,
yeah.
But most importantly because of the dream state he kind of creates in his films, the sound.
Mm-hmm.
The sound does the whole thing.
Sound is very important in Lynch.
And we've talked to the sound designers
from
Fire Walk With Me in the past. And just a great, overwhelming experience that movie was. At the theater, it's hard to get that experience when I'm watching it at home.
Mm-hmm.
That hit me when I first saw it at the theater. Number three. You might agree with this. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Yes. It bombed. I mean, that bombed Memorial Day weekend 1998, but it is a classic. It is Terry Gilliam at his one of his best. Johnny Depp, Benicio del Toro, Christina Ricci, everyone's good. If anyone can bring Hunter S. Thompson to life, it's those guys.
Hang on now.
Brilliant.
Hang on.
Yeah.
You didn't repeat my number three.
Yes, I did.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yes, I did.
You need to be more enthusiastic. Number two.
I thought I did a good job with number three, but obviously not. The co-host did not hear, okay?
All right. You ready? It's your time to shine, my friend.
Okay.
All right. You're the star. Number two. Thank you. Oh, that's beautiful. Also agreed, Jackie Brown.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally. There is no... This movie, people say, oh, Jerry, how could you like that movie? He adapted it. It's not his original work. I'm like, no. And you know why this movie is so good? This following summer, Out of Sight, Steven Soderbergh used the same character, Michael Keaton, as Ray Nicolette, to this continuity thing. Jackie Brown is brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Just awesome use of, Tarantino's use of music. The scenes, the dialogue, it's an awesome movie. You know, it's incredible. We could do a whole show devoted to it.
Yeah, and it's really, Tarantino, it's not that he adapts someone else's material, though he does pretty ingeniously,
mm-hmm.
so much as he finds his voice within the material and it elevates it.
Yes, it does, absolutely.
It's a great film, and I need to check this film out again. And it really has one of the all-time great "Oh no, you didn't" moments in
mm-hmm.
it. And when I say "Oh no, you didn't," I snap my fingers in the air.
Now I'm really curious what number one is.
I wholeheartedly agree with number one. It's getting good. The list has gotten good.
Yeah, it's getting much better.
Number one. It's Caligula. No, it's not. All right. Number one.
Number one. Numero uno.
It is Eyes Wide Shut.
I can see that. It's the happiest ending of any Kubrick movie, of course.
Yeah. We won't say the word.
We won't say it because we're trying to be family friendly now.
But let's just say it's the word that I always told Jerry not to say.
Yes, it's the word. And Tony Montana says it freely.
Yes, it's that word.
Yeah, it's that word.
Eyes Wide Shut, the number one most underrated movie according to this poll on TotalFilm.com. We did a tribute show to Eyes Wide Shut,
mm-hmm.
And everyone knows how I feel about Kubrick. that I'm not crazy about every film in his resume, but I think that between Clockwork and Eyes Wide Shut, for me, those are his two greatest treasures that I can return to over and over again and get something new out of them. It's so hypnotic, this film, and it's really exploring something that I think was – it's one of the most anticipated films ever. Because
it took so long. I mean,
it took a long time. You have a power couple in the lead, and given Kubrick's death 8 or 9 months previous to its release, there was enormous amount of buzz. Our last Kubrick masterpiece. So I think with that and with that attitude in mind, when they came out of the theater, they might have been a little disappointed, because that's the history of people's reaction to Kubrick films and critics' reactions to Kubrick films.
Yeah, I mean,
they mystify you.
There is a lot of mixed feelings, and I think also because this would be the last film by him, it was like, this is it, you know. And I think that, you know, I was not crazy about it the first time I watched it, but as I went on and I read more stuff about it and watched it again, there's a lot of great things in this movie. What I think is very interesting about this list is there's two Tom Cruise movies on it, two really underappreciated Tom Cruise movies on this list. It's interesting.
Yeah. What was the other one?
Vanilla Sky.
Oh, right. Right.
Yeah, see, you already forgot.
That's why it's so underrated.
Yeah. This list was not as... There are some really films that deserve to be on here. Some I don't. Jingle All the Way, I'm really not sure I understand why that needs to be on here, but...
It's not a total train wreck. There is an attitude, too, that Oliver Stone... that I don't like Oliver Stone.
That's not true at all. I thought you do like Oliver Stone quite a lot.
I love Oliver Stone. I have adored half of his films, and I think that JFK is an absolute American masterpiece.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that...
who's starting that rumor?
Thank you. People in our chat room, and I want to clarify for our archive listeners as well. Jamie likes Oliver Stone, and I appreciate most of the films on this underrated films list. But especially Eyes Wide Shut and Jackie Brown make the most sense to me. Our next guest is on the line, and this is going to be an exciting conversation.
Yes, it will.
Ellen Besson has been working in the field of animation for over 35 years. She's a former faculty member of Sheridan Institute. She's directed award-winning films for the National Film Board of Canada, conducted broadcasts on animation for CBC Radio, and served as a film curator for the Art Gallery of Ontario. Her works have graced the likes of the Museum of Modern Art and the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts. She's won the Award of Merit from the New York Animation Festival and honors at the American Film Festival, Ottawa Animation Festival. Man, I'm so... my writing is so... I can't even read my own typing. It's terrible. And the Berlin Educational Film Festival. She's also the creative director of the Kalamazoo Animation Festival International and a frequent instructor at the Ottawa International Animation Festival. That's a lot of syllables for me to get out. She's got quite a resume. Her new book, which you can purchase right here from our homepage, is titled Animation Unleashed, and it provides an in-depth primer on the principles that make animated works magical and transportive. It is a gorgeous book. It really is, and a must-read for novice artists, established artists, or simply fans of the animation genre. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome to the show Miss Ellen Besson. Ellen, are you with us?
I'm here.
Hi.
You read my whole resume. That's so cool. I thought we'd go another 5 minutes or so. I thought, oh, my God.
You notice I took a really deep breath before I started with that resume. It's really impressive. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. We're honored to have you.
Now, tell me about the films that captured your imagination growing up. Did they tend to be animated films?
They were certainly a major, major piece of it, you know, and it was one of those things where it's back far enough that to like animation as a kid was fine, but to still like it when you were 12 or 13 was you got, like, actively made fun of by people. Like, adults would kind of wonder why you were sitting in the corner reading comics and watching cartoons and wanting to talk about them, which was... So you had to kind of hold on to it, you know. It was a strange thing to be doing at that point. And that's just around the point where things were starting to revive. It's like that transition period from the original golden age that brought back everything that's happened now was just starting around then, which is sort of interesting to realize in retrospect.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I was incredibly impressed with Disney's features, and of course, as kids, because we were in Canada, we were actually being shown National Film Board animation just as part of the curriculum, and that stuff fascinated me, absolutely 100% fascinated me. I didn't know how they were doing it, but I loved it.
Mm.
And I'd say one of the big films that really struck me hard was Yellow Submarine.
Oh yeah,
huh.
Man! Imagine it like you're when you're seeing it for the first time, big screen, gorgeous, brand new prints, and you have absolutely zero preparation for this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's coming at you from absolutely nowhere, and I'd never seen animation like it. I'd never seen some of the techniques they were using. Everything about it. I mean, that was probably one of the major things that made me think, maybe I should be doing this.
Yeah.
Ultimately, yeah. Incredibly exciting.
Now, I hope you don't take offense to this question.
Oh, you can ask me anything.
I read I heard a review of Roger Ebert's when he was doing a show, and
okay.
he made an observation that growing up he always believed that animated movies were somehow more real to him than live action films. So, my question is, should he be committed, or do you feel the same way?
Well. The main thing I want to commit movie critics for is they don't have a high enough standard when they look at the animation. Their brains always seem to go to mush, which
okay.
means a lot of stuff that I think is actually nowhere near as good as it should be gets lots of, glowing critiques, which then confirms everybody's belief that they know what they're doing. So that's one of my biggest, chips on my shoulder. But in the sense that, we've gotten really confused lately about the idea of, there's a whole big thing about whether something's fiction or based on a true story.
Uh-huh.
As if that's the point of the thing, as opposed to that you actually manage to give emotional truth to something, which is really what it's about.
Uh-huh.
And animation is almost, it's unbelievable how effective it can be when you really find that key symbolic vehicle. Suddenly this thing blossoms that has, it has breadth, it has depth. The joy of walking somebody through the story, like a filmmaking process when they've got like a really solid foundation like that is more fun than anything I've ever done in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And then to see the thing on the screen that just reflects back so accurately is pure magic. And of course, in that sense, it can be more real. It can, the way when you see a really good caricature of somebody, it almost looks more like them than the actual person does?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same effect of that heightened effect brings the information forward so vividly that it makes it seem more real in a funny kind of way.
I think elaborating on the point, and you speak to this beautifully in your book.
Oh, thank you.
That it's important to remember that anything is possible in animation, and you should seize upon that. But your story has to support that kind of abandon.
Absolutely.
Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, if you don't build it in, I would say it's one of the best examples of something done badly would be a film like Pocahontas, Disney's Pocahontas,
right.
Where they were trying to make it. So, suddenly they're starting to give her, animated playmates. And, they're bringing the animals don't actually talk, but they are flitting around. They're, she's interacting in a way that doesn't really happen. You're walking along. The inherent platform is historical. And as soon as you're getting history, an even better one was Anastasia from back in the early, the mid-90s.
Right.
Where they had Rasputin, they're trying to make it like, okay, it really is the Russian Revolution. We're really dealing with historical aspects. Oh, look, there's Rasputin, and he's down there in limbo. And, they made it sound as if it was his curse that caused the Russian Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
That's not history. And
no,
that's
but
not
you, you don't honestly that's, think people go into something like that and expect historical fact, though, do you?
Well, but you're playing. But it's in terms of the storytelling, though. You end up being muddied. Like as a storyteller, if you aren't really sure what you're telling,
mm-hmm.
what you find happens, like a lot of films, if you analyze it, look pretty good, but there's something wonky about them. You'll discover that, like halfway through, it changed into a different story. For example, it
right.
started with one statement. And so when you're dealing with a historical situation, you can discover a total fantasy story within that,
mm-hmm.
but you have to know the lines between your fantasy and your reality.
Right, okay.
With Anastasia, they're dealing with the core story. It started because the royal family and their whole system was screwed up. To add a major fantasy element in that twists it into without taking that whole story, if you take the whole story into something symbolic, then you reveal new information. When you play with history and you present it essentially historically and then just throw in one wonky element, it is a neither here nor, it's really the whole film was in limbo, basically.
Right.
And it kind of sticks. You can't really go one way. You can't really go the other. You can't justify it. There's no reason for it to be there. Nor does it really throw new light. In fact, it throws distorted light onto the story. So it's kind of a weird thing they do when they do that.
Yeah. You know, Anastasia, if I remember correctly, I think that was the first, if not one of the first, animation efforts from Fox. When
yeah.
they,
that's correct, yes. Yeah.
When they refurbished into their animation studio,
yep.
Which threatened Disney, who's had a, you know, it's been their marketplace for so long.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
With other people getting into the animation game,
right?
Obviously, Disney has a patent on this type of film. But DreamWorks is coming up. Do you see that one group of talents are better at this than the other overall?
I think at this point there's no one clear-cut absolute master the way there would have been, you know, back in the day with Disney when they really didn't
right.
have much. I mean, there were always other people attempting, and Disney was so much better.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting field right now. They each have their strengths. I mean, Pixar, obviously, I mean, it's in conjunction with Disney, but it clearly is its own little ship.
Right.
And I would say of the bunch, they're probably still the most solid. Although, again, their stories, except occasionally, still have a kind of they're not as sure on story as they think they are, which is one of those oddball things. You
yeah.
can always find something in there that really, something important that's there that would make the film that much better. But overall, I'd say, you know, they have an especially interesting setup going on there. And probably DreamWorks, I would say, is coming in second at this point with a very, very different style.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more of a kind of a, often a clothesline for hanging jokes on style. Or like it's
right.
less story-driven and more either character or situation-driven.
Right.
It isn't always my favorite, but it's funny. I mean, when it works, it's a real entertainment factor, and it's got a great kind of coming in out of sideways craziness to the humor.
Yeah, and what interests me about the newer animated movies that work well for me is they work well for me for the same reasons that narrative live action films do.
Yeah, exactly.
And a lot of your lessons in this book that you share can be applied to both things, like the importance of theme and character and story and motivation. Those kinds of elements never really died, no matter what the genre is.
Well, thank you for pointing that out, because of course as I was writing, I was thinking, you know, there are variations on a theme, and there's things you each side learns from the other. And of course, more and more they're coming together into one new form,
yeah.
And so both sides knowing what the other is doing becomes all the more important.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there's also always technical aspects that, you know, it's always interesting, I find, that when you see somebody using the details of a certain technique to the nth degree, that then enriches the whole story even more. It doesn't mean you can't get a good film without enhancing it, without engaging that. But like I think of like Toy Story, which is one of my favorite relatively contemporary features.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, that feature, you know, you were dealing with a relatively new technology at that point, and you know, you could have told the story in 2D, you could have told it in puppet animation, but neither would have produced that sense that it was actually some kind of live action footage that couldn't be possible. And the level of magic that added to it was, you know, incomparable, basically. So that to me is like the great use of when you have the absolute match of technique to story content.
Mm-hmm.
Something else starts to happen.
Mm.
And those are always my classics, almost always have that quality.
Let's talk a little bit about technology, because the trends in animation tend to follow advancing technologies.
Very much so, yeah.
So is 2D, is that dying or is it already dead?
Well, firstly, do you like 2D personally? Like when you see 2D films, how does it affect you when you see it?
What about anime? What about the Japanese?
Yeah.
I love that stuff. I still
exactly.
I think that stuff is incredible. Beautiful, almost poetic. Like Spirited Away or something like that.
Oh, Spirited Away is one of my absolute top favorite films.
It's an incredible, very moving film. Very emotional.
And would you have wanted to see that in 3D? Do you mind? Do you care? Does it make any difference?
I don't think it would work as well. I think the anime is, I come from the old school of anime, and I was growing up with Kimba and all that stuff, Astro
right,
Boy,
yeah.
Star Blazers, all that. So I always love like these the movies, when these movies come out, Spirited Away, Howl's Moving Castle, all those films. I just think they're beautiful the way they are.
What I find happens is that at any given time, you know, I mean, I think the real reason 2D got shunted off to the side was there was that period, you know, Disney came out of the box real hard in the late 80s with, you know, and they had, you know, three in a row that were absolute total hits.
Mm-hmm.
And then they got, I'm not an insider. I'm always, you know, I'm the outsider looking in, which is, you know, sometimes an advantage to be that person, but it means I don't necessarily know what the their actual thinking was necessarily for how they made their decisions.
Yeah.
But the films they started to make in the mid-90s were starting to miss the mark in terms of audience. They were getting,
right.
you know is The Hunchback of Notre Dame really children's fare? Even Pocahontas. I mean, you know, so they were kind of, they're not really, the adults aren't going to go for this necessarily, and the kids aren't really going to go for this. So the films weren't doing as well, and they decided it was because they were 2D.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, Toy Story comes out, it's a big hit, and it's kind of this very superficial thinking. To me, 2D can go places that 3D never will be able to.
Right.
Okay.
You know, the closer you get to the real world, the more locked in you are to a certain degree. It's an automatic thing. I mean, you can push, and we're going to get more used to that, but it's still, there's a flexibility to a flat piece of paper,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
and that what an animator can do with it, and making, you know, deciding even by a line that suddenly something is inside and something is outside space, you know what I mean? And yet it's still all flat. And so I think the same way that they had to rediscover acoustic music,
right.
that there'll be the realization that as long as you tell a good story, you have to have the right story.
Right.
That the technique definitely has its look. I still love the look of 2D animation. It's got an enchantment for me that's like nothing else.
I think so, too. And I think for a lot of people, too, there's, and this is happening in lots of different areas, you like music and certainly in the animation arena. There's such a respect for the artist that sits down with pencils and in hand and draws these amazing films out. And if I'm not mistaken, help me out, Jerry. The head of Pixar.
Don Lasseter was, and
Lasseter,
God, is it Andrew? We're all going to bubble around here.
I think it's Lasseter, though.
Lasseter was for many years. He's over at Disney now, actually, but yeah.
Lasseter pushed for Disney, actually, to maintain a 2D, didn't he?
Yes, I believe he did, because that was where he came from. He was a 2D animator for many years, so that
yeah.
was his, you know, his first love.
Mm.
Now,
we're talking about these films. You mentioned Toy Story. And the two most acclaimed films of the last year in the animation arena were WALL-E and Kung Fu Panda.
Right.
Uber mega hits worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to have loved WALL-E, and I
okay.
understand that your feelings about it run kind of counter to that.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm that one, you know, that one sheep going backwards through the big herd.
That's fine.
Why is it? What is it about that you didn't like?
Well, it's interesting. I just had a discussion with someone else that last week that really kind of helped me really identify what I was thinking. The first 20 minutes or so, 15, 20 minutes, when it's just with WALL-E on the desolated Earth,
mm-hmm.
tour de force, unbelievable. I mean, that is like the animator's masterpiece work where you actually, almost no words,
right.
almost nothing, just the character against this really harsh background, and you're falling in love with this guy, just watching him
right.
cope. Brilliant, poignant, engaging. Now, to me, actually, what goes on with WALL-E is exactly where I find that Pixar gets into trouble with its films most of the time. And they're probably going to hate me for saying this, but I got to say what I think.
Right.
As soon as they went, so basically what they established there was a story about a lonely guy.
Yeah.
And if they had wanted to get into deeper themes about that, into desolation and into, you know, the destruction of the Earth, etc., the reality is they never actually had to leave the planet. They could have done everything they wanted to do with just, you know, it was the debris that was left around. The detritus was the representation of human destruction.
Mm-hmm.
as soon as they took it off the planet and went, you know, so basically he's off the planet really for one thing. He's searching for love. That's really the only driving force. But as soon as he goes to the spaceship, suddenly we are into Noah's Ark with a whole, it's a whole other story. We're into comments on consumer culture, which in fact, I mean, it's sort of reflective, but not the way they were handling it. It was much more almost like a satiric thing about you know, kind of conformity and all these things. And most notably, it suddenly became major action sequence after major action sequence, which is usually a sign that the story itself is no longer feeding the action of what has to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
So there's tons and tons of characters. There's tons and tons of stuff. And most of it really, and it seems to be saying all this brilliant stuff, but really all it is just a series of obstacles to making it harder for him to get his love. That's all it really is. Yet, with none of it actually reflecting back into the main story.
Mm.
If you compare that to a story, I'm going to go back to Toy Story, which I think is still basically their greatest film. There what you had was a core, you know, analogy that fed the entire story, so that everything really had to grow out of actions that Woody had to took or didn't do. It was a true character-driven story with its roots in a real emotional problem, which was expressed perfectly by its analogy.
Right.
Because it isn't just about talking toys. It's about the reality that if you look at the world from a toy's point of view, it's a terrible world. A toy lives inside this enclosed world with this extreme hierarchy in which the goal is to climb to the top and be the favorite toy, but the god who's governing it is a child, a capricious child who will love you one next day and throw you out the next, and you have no control over that.
Yeah.
That's an incredible and very deep emotional reality to start as the beginning point of your film. And so from there, everything about the film of Woody being the head but actually being the most anxious guy because he was too aware of being a toy,
yeah,
counterbalancing him against Buzz Lightyear, who didn't know he was a toy at all, so he had false confidence, so you had lack of confidence versus false confidence, and the two having to come together into balance. And you can go through that film shot by shot and sequence by sequence and see, watch Woody like slowly lose everything that he's got. I mean, he, you know, what happens basically is it's his worst fear,
yeah,
to end up in the outer world, but he actually does everything himself, driven by his anxiety to make it happen, and then has to find his way back. You can go through the whole film on that level. You can't do it with Wall-E.
I agree with you wholeheartedly about Toy Story, and I'm thinking about that and how well it works with those themes and those fears that we have as children, and they never leave you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that could be one of the reasons why these films are just as enlightening and entertaining for adults as they are
when they're at their best.
Yeah.
When they're at their best, they tap themes that actually we carry into adulthood. You said it really beautifully there. We carry them into adulthood, and they're still reflected in the way our lives are lived. You know, we're still dealing with fears of losing our place in society, of losing home, of, you know, losing status, of losing identity.
Right.
So for me, Wall-E got the love story was not strong enough the way it was written to be the vehicle for all that stuff. So then all the action and all the other themes were just partially developed. They didn't really make any difference to the outcome of the story one way or the other, not really. And when they end, it really was just so Wall-E would get his girlfriend.
Right.
Then it trivialized stuff that should be very powerful. So that was the thematic elements not being in sync with each other, basically.
That was a very articulate argument. So
thank you.
I will give you no grief about that. But animation has been used and is currently being used for not necessarily quote unquote children's pictures. You see it in projects like Waltz with Bashir and more kind of serious.
Let's
project.
Call it adult content.
Adult.
You know, it's always adult content, but it's always adult theme,
right.
But it's the vehicle, you know, when you actually go fully out and you can explore on an adult level, you can be barefaced about it.
It's aimed, yeah. Now, is that a trend that you feel in general heightens these projects? And what does that do?
I think it does something really different and really interesting. I think part of what's happening, and which I find really fascinating, having, you know, been around long enough to watch some trends, is that, first place, animators as a group have tended to be the most kind of inward turning, wanting distance from the world, wanting distance from their problems kind of people. And it's occurred to me recently how odd it is that a style of filmmaking that in fact is capable of being the most literally personal, like, you know, certain styles of animating are intended so that you literally have a thumb, your thumb on every frame. I mean, you know, some of the great solo animators can do an entire feature, and everything you see there, they not only have created, but they've controlled within the frame and from frame to frame, and it's, you know, it's crazy making, but they can do it. And yet we have tended to push away so that it comes, that instead of coming out directly, it comes up bubbling through the analogy, but we need a lot of space in there before we can look at it, you know, distancing techniques. I think it's really meaningful that there is now way more movement through a lot of stuff. We've definitely seen with films like Waltz with Bashir. There was, did you guys run across a National Film Board film from a couple years ago called Ryan that won the Oscar in maybe 3 years ago, I think?
An amazing, no, I know of it, but I've never seen it.
If you get a chance to see it, it's an amazing film. And Chris Landris is, you know, one of the preeminent 3D animators and the one who's pushing that real ability for the characters to seem near real.
Right.
Like just this side of being live action and yet not. But he also then takes another degree. Like he turns it into abstract art. Or not abstract art. He turns it into like surreal art. So he combines, you know, he has human figures and then blasts part of their heads off and distorts them in different ways. So there's a frame of reality and then pushed into another dimension. Really, really interesting use of the technology. But again, so yeah, that willingness finally for animators to look at the dark side straight on, I think is a very healthy thing. For one thing, for the animators, it's really good.
Yeah.
And I think for the art form, it's going to open it up. I mean, the family feature is a great thing. It's a beautiful and very hard kind of entertainment to create, and I have 100% respect for people who do it well. But there's no reason why animation should be restricted to that. There's no reason why it can't be doing full-scale adult. The potential for it is actually, like, you know, like imagine as if Salvador Dali was doing a feature film. You know what I mean? Like, why shouldn't that be? That would be amazing. But you need to be able to be willing to go into the depth of your soul and take a look at what's there and name it for what it is in order to do that.
Speaking of a pretty dark project, it just came out recently, and it's been pretty successful. And it's Coraline. I look at this level of artistry,
yes,
and it's just staggering.
Absolutely,
it is.
Yeah, a masterwork. Yep.
Yeah. So you're impressed by that?
Oh, totally.
One?
Well, Henry Selick, I think, is one of our great modern animation masters.
Oh, he is.
One thing, and
without
I'm so happy to see him being handed features. He's and to get a big vehicle, you know, and finally get his name out there. That, you know, he's, a lot of people didn't know that he directed Nightmare Before Christmas. People were thinking it was Tim Burton. So I'm very, very glad to see him getting his full recognition.
Yeah,
he's astonishing.
One quick question, just what do you think of Richard Linklater's animated, The Waking Life and A Scanner Darkly? Do you have any opinion on those?
Oh, yeah, very strong. Fascinatingly wonky.
Yeah, I'll give you that, yeah.
Do you guys like them or hate them? Where
oh,
are
I think,
you?
Oh, I think I like Richard Linklater a lot, and I love both of those films.
Me too.
Okay,
me too.
The Waking Life was, when I first started watching, I thought, oh my God, I'm not going to make it through this. And I'm glad I actually was seeing it in a theater, so, you know, with other people,
you don't
get up and walk away.
Theater, yeah.
I'm feeling slightly seasick after the first couple of minutes. And then I started to kind of sink into it. And I thought, okay, this is really interesting, especially once I got into it long enough to see that he was actually handing out whole sections to different artists and letting them go to town with it.
Right.
And so I thought, first place, I loved it as the idea of that a film can work with the tiniest of stories. I mean, all the story had to be was the guy was asleep and he was trying to wake up.
Right.
But that was a journey. You know, that was enough of a mission to be on
to
drive the story, which I thought was amazing. So a lot of people wouldn't think that so, but I thought, no, he actually pulled off something that's a really interesting little feat there.
Right.
Mm. The main thing I'd say where it frustrated me was I felt that he didn't understand the potential of what he was doing quite yet, because there were so many areas where, beginning with that, because he had that solid live, you know, he basically had that soundtrack, which is the continuity of the film.
Right.
That once you have that, and animation is brilliant for this, once you've got that as the through line for your story, you actually then can allow the visuals a tremendous amount of variation without losing your audience whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
You can take them there and bring them back, take them, bring them back. And he kind of got that a little bit, but there was, I don't know if he didn't know how to encourage his animators down those rows or if he actually held them back, that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I kept looking at scenes going, God, he could have done 20 more things there or taken it so much further in the exaggeration and gotten that much more out of it that it would have been that much better.
Right.
So I found that one was still really interesting, and I you know, applauded the guy for taking the chance and taking the leap and again, giving it an adult subject matter. And I wish, I'd almost like to see him redo it, to tell you the truth, with,
right.
with maybe with a, some, another animation director breathing down his neck saying, hey, why don't you try this? Because I think, I can't imagine he wouldn't like it if he could see what he could do with it, you know what I mean?
Right.
Through a Scanner Darkly, again, I enjoyed that film. I mean, there's
I think
just
you and I are the only ones who enjoyed it.
Okay, well, we're the club.
Though.
We'll have to have another website which is just...
Well, looking at the future of animation,
it's
very much dependent upon not only technology and where that takes us, but our future generation of artists. And I know that you instruct many of them and correspond with many of them. Is that an exciting group of talents coming up in the animation field, in your opinion?
They are so amazingly talented. I don't actively teach at Sheridan anymore. I was teaching there on and off from about the late 80s through till 2002.
But you still conduct courses, am I correct? And
pardon me?
You still occasionally conduct courses?
I do workshops. I still work with a lot of my former students, sometimes
mm-hmm.
one-on-one, and I have other students. My greatest pleasure is when someone lets me mentor right from first idea through to finished piece, because, of course, there's storytelling and communication that's affected by every, as there is with every medium. Everything's always affecting, and it's lovely to be able to be that set of eyes coming in all the way through. I see amazing talent out there. People doing the most, I mean, the gift is there and the passion is there, which is the thing, you know, like people aren't getting jaded about it. They're still really excited about it.
Yeah.
And willing to do, I mean, animation in a way is, it's great that it is so much work to do it, but it doesn't matter what tool you use, it's always medieval in its work practices. You have to be willing to get in there. It's like a grunt work always. And there's not huge glory for the individual, generally speaking, except for a very, very small number of people.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to do it, you have to love it. There's no other way. Otherwise, you'd go crazy. I mean, there's just no way around it.
Yeah.
So it's a good screen. People don't generally stay with it unless they feel a certain something about it. And so you get this great combination of huge talent and real love for it, like a real devotion to it, which I think is a wonderful thing to see in this world.
Yeah, and that's true of anything across the creative arts. It,
mm-hmm.
you have to be driven by an undying passion.
Otherwise, you can't do it.
You have
to be able to let it consume a certain part of your life and be happy to let that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The book is called Animation Unleashed, 100 Principles Every Animator, Comic Book Writer, Filmmaker, Video Artist, and Game Developer Should Know. Tell me, it's a terrific book, and you can purchase it on the homepage of our website here. Tell me the need for this book when you looked and saw what other works were out there. What did you feel was missing from the marketplace?
Well, I think what was missing was the clarifying of those principles. You'll find a lot of the same stuff scattered through other books, but it's hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what you don't get of is enough of the explanation of it. You don't get enough of the example. So what I tried to do with this book, on the one hand, animation lovers who haven't done the depth, I mean, you'll be sent off to look for films and look for certain examples and just the tremendous fun of really seeing what's on the screen. But the primary group was students. It was the common problems they were hitting. When you work with lots of people, you start to see certain trends. So there were certain roadblocks that students were always getting. And then even professionals, there's that weird thing that, you know, it's one thing to be outside and looking in, watching someone else's work and think, oh, I would do this, I would do that. You know, we all know that. When you're in production, especially if you're dealing with something that's real to you, it's very easy to get lost.
Yeah.
And so this book is designed to go, oh, my God, I'm into the soundtrack, and I don't know what to do with the sound effects. I'm going crazy here. You flip open the book, and you can go to that section. A lot of it's the format of the book is unique. You can go, oh, yeah, sound effects, here it is. And you'll get something in there which will jog your memory. It's either something you didn't know that you didn't think about, or you knew but you couldn't remember. You go, oh, yeah, that's the thing I need to do. That's going to get me through. So it's the crystallization of that concrete, really essentially for people in the midst of making a film to keep them from bogging down, and then also, with any luck, also to inspire them to go, oh, yeah, I forgot that I could do that much more with the animation than I thought I could. When you slide into default position, which people often do, they're accidentally going to live-action solutions and forgetting animated solutions,
right,
for example.
Right.
Yeah. It'll go, oh, yeah, you just need that jog to start to get your own imagination going. And the reason it's so heavily illustrated also is I hope people will go, God, I'm blocking here. You flip open, you see Bryce Hallett, who is my amazing illustrator. I have to give him a credit here.
They're terrific, yeah.
He was so unbelievable to work with. It was such a great, team effort, and he was just fantastic what he brought to it. But you can flip it open and go, oh, yeah, there's a visual idea, too, that's going to help jog me into rethinking my work as well. That's what I hope it does for people.
Yeah, it's a great book, and I very much enjoyed reading it. And it is a beautiful a beautiful publication with just great illustrations, as you just mentioned.
Thank you. I always have to say thanks to my publishers. They were amazing as well. Michael Wiese Productions was the resources they made available to me was fantastic.
They're very good. We speak to many of their authors, and they're a solid group, and we love their work. Animation Unleashed, pick it up. I urge all of our listeners to do that. It's a great, great book. And Ellen, you're a great guest, and I appreciate your time tonight very much.
You are both wonderful to talk to. It was so much fun.
They come back anytime.
That would be great. I would love to.
Okay, thank you so much,
okay.
Ellen.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Ellen Besson. Animation Unleashed is the book. Interesting topics tonight, Jerry.
Yes, this is a great show tonight. And that list got better. I'm still I was really surprised that the underrated list got so much better.
Yes, and we talked about great animated
about
features.
Passion
yeah.
was the big thing tonight. You have to have passion.
I think so. It's all about passion.
It is.
Yeah. If only I were this passionate when I hang up the phone and end a show. after I do that. All right. We thank everyone for joining us tonight. Sunday night is still kind of in limbo. I don't know what guests will come on. We're doing a series of pre-recordeds. I don't know if they will air on Sunday or not, which just might be a free-form show. We also have an Empire of the Sun tribute show that's all done and ready to broadcast. So we got to find a place for that.
Right, yeah.
That's a good spot to be in when you have Alan Davia.
Yeah, it is.
A whole Alan Davia interview about Empire of the Sun, and you're just trying to figure out where to air it. Wow. We thank everyone out there for listening. A great chat room tonight, and thank you to our archive listeners. We urge you to choose our show as one of your favorites on Blog Talk Radio. That will allow you to get updates. Jerry and I get updates ourselves, so we don't forget about our show. And also subscribe by iTunes. And you'll automatically get each of our terrific guests, interviews, and topic conversations downloaded on your computer. What could be better than that?
That's right.
Go see Race to Witch Mountain this Friday. Go see Last House on the Left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Listen to our shows again first, so you'll...
Yeah, listen to all the shows. All of them. All
fuller
of them.
Appreciation of it.
Yeah.
Jerry, you're checking out both this weekend, right?
I'm going to definitely check out both. And I guess next weekend Duplicity comes out, and I'm really looking forward to that.
We just got offered an actor from Duplicity.
Oh, Clive Owen? I had to say that,
It's not out of bounds, I guess.
Right.
But no, not Clive Owen. But I'm looking forward to that movie. April, I hope April has some offerings that I'm excited about because it looks like a pretty slow month.
It could be, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Guys, thank you so much. Jerry, thank you, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you, and have a great night, everyone.
See you Sunday night. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.